This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Gay News Week on Joy 94.9.
Gay News Week on Joy 94.9.
We're joined by former US Department Health and Human Service Assistant Secretary Mr. David Hansel, who has now joined KPMG as head of their Global Human Service Social Practice. Welcome, David. Thank you for spending time with us.
I'm delighted to be here.
That's good. How long are you actually spending in Australia at the moment?
I'll be here altogether about 2 weeks. I've had a wonderful week traveling through Sydney and Canberra, and now in Melbourne this week, and am looking forward to spending some holiday time here up in Queensland, and then back to Sydney at the end of next week.
Fantastic.
We might get straight into it. You've done a lot over your career, just reading your bio. Can you give us an overview of the most important points or the most exciting achievements that you've had up to this point?
Sure. I've been actually very fortunate. I've had some really wonderful opportunities working in government in the U.S. and doing other things. Probably the most emotionally significant experiences that I've had go back some years when I was working in New York City in the early days in response to the HIV/AIDS epidemic, which, as I'm sure you know, struck New York very early. New York was one of the very early epicenters of the epidemic. Yeah. And back in the mid-1980s or so, when it was a very, very frightening time, the epidemic had emerged. We didn't really know what it was. Nobody knew where it was going. And I was involved with one of the first organizations that was developed in response to the epidemic, the Gay Men's Health Crisis. It was really an organization that grew out of the AIDS community. It was in response to the sense that the community needed to mobilize mm-hmm. on its own on behalf. And we started fairly small, but we started developing a set of prevention interventions help protect initially gay men, but then lesbians and the broader community as well, against HIV transmission risks, as well as social support programs, and also did quite a bit of work with government trying to shape responses in the healthcare and social services domain. So I did that for a number of years, and actually then transitioned into government in New York City, which is my home and has been my home for many, many yep. years. And I ran the HIV/AIDS public health program for the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene for some time, and that was really my transition into government. So the early phase of my work was all around HIV/AIDS. More recently, I've worked more broadly in human services, and the last thing I've done, which I guess I would say was sort of the other maybe capstone of and really exciting time that I've had, was to work in the Obama administration for the past couple of years as the acting assistant secretary, Sam, as you mentioned, for what's called the Administration for Children and Families, which is a part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services that is responsible for protecting vulnerable youth, other vulnerable populations, providing income support to low-income Americans, and a whole range of other human services support. So I had the very exciting opportunity to participate in federal government in the Obama administration and to help shape policies to try to protect children, youth, and families.
Fantastic. Now, during your time that you were in New York, you were elected as the first openly gay commissioner. And how was that at the time, the reactions to that and within the GLBTI and the broader community?
Well, I was actually appointed, or actually technically I was nominated. Yep. The way that the system works in the U.S., the governor of the state, and this time it was a governor named Spitzer, Elliot Spitzer, nominated me to serve as commissioner of a state agency called the Office of Temporary and Disability Assistance. And then I had to go before the state Senate and be confirmed into that position. It was an enormous honor to be the first openly gay man or lesbian to serve in a commissioner level role in New York State, and it was wonderful. And I think I got a great deal of support from the community. But the truth is, you know, New York is a very supportive place, and so I don't think it was an exceptional thing. But I think it was a great vindication for the community and To be in that position, and it enabled me to do some things that I think were helpful to provide support for people in the community as well as others.
You mentioned in that you had to do a confirmation hearing. Was that the same when you moved into the Obama administration? Did you have to do a similar hearing for your position? Because we see those hearings occasionally on television, particularly at the Senate level for things in the States, and they're a little bit of a blood sport. Can you give us a...
They can be somewhat contentious. I actually did not go through that process myself. In fact, that's the reason my position was an acting assistant secretary position, so I did not actually go before the Senate for confirmation. It can be a difficult process, but fortunately that didn't happen in my case, and it wasn't a process that I had to go through.
So you started as a lawyer. Is that right?
That's right.
So what sort of law did you do before you got into the HIV project work and things that you did later?
Well, actually, it's an interesting question because my initial area of practice was environmental law.
Okay.
And in truth, that's what I thought would be my career. I thought that's what I would be doing. And if it hadn't been for the AIDS crisis, mm-hmm. and if it hadn't been for being drawn into that sort of work, I probably would have remained as an environmental lawyer. But things changed because I felt it was an issue that was just so compelling that I wanted to do what I could do and try to apply my professional skills. But my initial work at Gay Men's Health Crisis, GMHC, actually was legal. I was the head of the legal services program, and so we were responsible for providing a whole range of legal services to people with HIV infection and AIDS. And sadly, in those days, because this was prior to the advent of combination therapies and protease inhibitors and really effective treatments for HIV, so unfortunately, it was still in the days when an HIV diagnosis was essentially a terminal diagnosis. And so the people we were dealing with generally were quite ill, and the issues we were dealing with had to do a good deal with drafting wills, doing estate planning, a lot of end-of-life issues. Very, very difficult, as well as serious discrimination. This was still the time when there was tremendous paranoia among the general public about HIV and how it was transmitted. And so we had people who were being fired from their jobs, people who were being thrown out of their apartments, people who were being denied medical care because of their HIV status. So the work I was doing was either directly or overseeing we had actually quite an army of volunteer attorneys. We had a real outpouring of lawyers who wanted to volunteer in this area. But providing legal services to people who were facing just horrendous things happening to them because of their HIV status.
Gay News Week on Joy 94.9.
Gay News Week on Joy 94.9.
We are here with David Hansel, and we're having a chat about his career across HIV activism and working in the Obama administration.
It's being said that the Obama administration had a clear mandate, comprehensive human rights, including the elimination of violence and discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. Do you believe this was an agenda that he had in mind when he was running for office, or was part of a progression of his education within the system once he was elected?
I wouldn't be able to speak to his state of mind.
Do you think the way that it actually moved?
Well, I think if you look at the things that he's done, which are very significant, he has removed the don't ask, don't tell policy in the U.S. military, so he's made it possible for people, gay and lesbian people, to serve openly in the military. He has announced that he would like to see the Defense of Marriage Act repealed so that states would not be required to discriminate based on the type of marriage or discriminate against same-sex marriages. He has recently announced his personal support for same-sex marriage. So, you know, all I can say is you can look at his record and draw your own conclusions about that. But I think that, I think we've seen a lot of positive change in the U.S., and I'm delighted by that, and I think we're going to continue to see things move forward.
It's fantastic because, of course, you know, early on in his time, there was, I'm not quite ready, I'm not quite at that space to, you know, make my decision or let it be known on how I actually feel about things. And, we weren't getting a clear picture over here sometimes of the process of going up into that. And the next thing we know that we hear through the news here in Australia that Obama has declared his support for same-sex unions. So mm-hmm. I suppose it was more how things were sort of, you know, felt things at travelling and being living in the US at the time.
And mm-hmm. I think that reflects back off and the situation here where our Prime Minister is very adamantly against. So the juxtaposition here was very strong for us as the leader of two countries making different decisions on the issue. Moving along a little bit, in a previous position that you had, a conservative activist said that you had the power to cut funding for adoption to states that do not allow same-sex couples to adopt. Can you talk us through what happened in that circumstance? And this is obviously not someone who you might consider as an ally.
Well, no, I remember seeing that posted on a blog somewhere, and that, of course, was absolutely not true.
Yeah.
What is true is that in my role as the Acting Assistant Secretary for Children and Families, I had responsibility for federal policy on adoption and federal policy on child welfare and child protection in general. And the way that works in the U.S. is that the federal government provides funding to states, but the states actually administer the programs. So what we did in the time that I was there was to issue guidance to states to encourage them to adopt systems of support that were respectful of all kids in the child welfare program, all kids in out-of-home care and foster care, all kids in runaway and homeless youth situations or programs, and to make sure that their programs were sensitive, culturally competent, and respectful of the needs of LGBT kids, just like all other kids in the system. So my goal and our goal in the time that I was there was to make sure that those programs, which are administered at the state level, were as inclusive as possible and were as sensitive as possible. And that's what we tried to do. And I think some of the guidance we issued has had impact on states and has encouraged states to look at their programs and make sure that they are truly reflecting the needs of all the children that they're responsible for.
And also with not only the needs of the children, but also I was reading up that you were also doing some work with moves with allowing same-sex parents to be allowed to be allowed to adopt as well.
Yes. Well, one of the very strong policies in the U.S. is to encourage permanency situations for children, so that if children are out of home care for whatever reason, and it's determined by the child welfare officials that it's not going to be possible for them to return to the family where they were living, there's a strong policy in the U.S. to try to move them to a permanent situation, and in most cases that would be adoption, so that there would actually be a new permanent family situation and new permanent parents for those kids. One of our policy objectives, again, working with the states who administer the programs, was to create as many opportunities for children to find adoptive homes as possible and to broaden the pool of potential adoptive parents. And so in that regard, we encourage states to encourage all potential parents, including lesbians and gay men, who were interested and prepared to be adoptive parents or foster parents, to have that opportunity, to have the training and the resources and the support to do that. So it was really all part of an overall effort to create as many opportunities for children to move into permanent homes, into foster homes, into adoptive homes as possible.
Another person who you might not regard as an ally has said of you that your positions that you've taken on supporting fatherhood and the importance of fathers is inconsistent with supporting same-sex families and same-sex adoption. How do you reconcile those things, having made a few strong statements about the strength and necessity of fathers?
Well, you've done a good bit of Google research on me, haven't you?
A little bit.
Well, I think that's absolutely wrong. I mean, again, my view is that all children deserve to have the emotional support of both of their parents, to the financial support of both of their parents. Mm. It doesn't matter who their parents are. It doesn't matter what kind of relationship. A parent has a responsibility to support the child. And so our work around responsible fatherhood was really stemmed from that commitment that that men who father children have the responsibility to care for their children, to provide financial support for their children, to be there emotionally for their children, in exactly the same way that every parent has that responsibility. And sexual orientation has nothing to do with it. It's really about the responsibility of parenthood.
So it was basically about them using the argument that you're saying that, you know, as a father, you need to be responsible for your child, and they're using that argument to instill the core Christian values that every family should have a mother and a father instead of being allowed them to have a nice, safe, happy home as the ultimate family for that child, regardless of the sex of the parents.
Mm-hmm. Well, my view is, as I said, every parent has a responsibility. A father or two fathers have responsibility for the children. A mother or two mothers, a father and a mother have responsibility. It doesn't depend on sexual orientation. It doesn't depend on the nature of the family. Every parent has a responsibility to care for their child.
Absolutely. Reports this week in Australia have Australia leading the way worldwide with obesity statistics, where in the past it has been the US has really been put out there in that regard. Recently here, welfare authorities have sought court orders for several Victorian children to be placed in care due to obesity. Do you think that that is going to become a global issue?
You know, this is a huge issue in the U.S., and the statistics are actually very frightening in the U.S. I don't know the details as well, of course, in Australia, but in the U.S., about 17% of children are obese. About a third of adults are obese, and the numbers are going up pretty dramatically. So this is a great area of concern. I think it's primarily a public health concern, an issue that needs to be addressed from a public health perspective. It's not primarily, I think, a child welfare concern. It's a public health concern. And so the issue is, what do we need to do to educate families, again, to educate parents about how to care for their children, how to make sure that their children's nutritional needs are being met in a way that will also keep their kids healthy. And that's the challenge. And I have certainly observed in the week I've been here, it's becoming an increasingly large issue in Australia as well.
Increasingly large issue.
Yes. Poor choice of words.
One of the programs that you were involved in that struck me as particularly progressive and that I liked was a Heartland Alliance in Chicago that was funded for the resettlement of lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender refugees. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yes. One of the responsibilities of the agency that I ran was the resettlement of refugees coming to the U.S. from all parts of the world. The U.S., actually, this is a little-known fact, even in the States. The U.S. actually receives and resettles more refugees internationally than any other country in the world. It's actually something, I think, of which the U.S. can be very proud. And our responsibility within my agency was, once the refugees arrived in the U.S., to make sure that they were settled into communities, that they were housed, that they had employment, that they were basically integrated into their communities. And in doing that, we looked at basically all the needs that those refugees had. They were very diverse. They came from, you know, dozens of different countries around the world. Sometimes they were individuals, sometimes they were families, sometimes they were children. And the role of our, what we called our Office of Refugee Resettlement, was to make sure that every refugee had the support that they needed to integrate into a community that was accepting and comfortable for them. We were seeing an increasingly large number of LGBT refugees who were arriving, and we wanted to make sure that they were getting the same sort of sensitive care and support. And so we thought it would be helpful, because we worked with many different refugee services organizations around the country that had varying degrees of familiarity with LGBT refugees. We thought it would be useful to fund an organization that did have a lot of experience in that area to provide training and technical assistance to make sure that all the organizations that were supporting refugees had the same level of competence to do that.
Gay News Week on Joy 94.9.
Gay News Week on Joy 94.9.
David, the religious right in the USA seems to have to be particularly influential politically from our perspective. How do you think that that affects a lot of policy making in the US, you know, particularly with things like the pastors affecting rights for marriage equality in some states like South Carolina? Do you think that a lot of the religious organizations are having a little bit more effect with that?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, the U.S. has a very robust political culture. there are a lot of people with a lot of different perspectives. And the U.S. has, strong, deep religious traditions that really vary across the political spectrum. So there certainly are some that are more conservative voices than others, and the states in which they have more representation, it's a stronger voice. But we also have a strong tradition in the U.S. of the separation of church and state, and so ultimately decisions are made by government, and government weighs, I think, all the voices that come to the table and makes decisions.
Because of course the main difference between Australia and the U.S. as far as the Marriage Act is in Australia it's a federal act, but in the U.S. of course it's a decision that is made state by state. So as much as Obama can say that he supports the right for same-sex people to be married, it is still up to each state to bring that law in. Is that right?
Yes, yes. Marriage is a state-by-state policy in the U.S. And each state makes its own decision about that. That's correct.
An extension from that is that some of the conservative groups, particularly African-American conservative religious groups, say that gay rights are not a civil rights issue. How do you respond to that? Or what are your thoughts about that? Because it seems inconsistent that a group that ought to be able to spot discrimination very well and fight against it chooses to ignore this one.
Well, I can only, you know, speak from my personal perspective. I can't speak for other organizations. Yeah, yeah. But from my perspective, I don't think it's about trying to create some kind of a parity between civil rights for African Americans or other racial or ethnic groups and gay rights. I think each issue stands on its own merits. I think, you know, the civil rights movement in the U.S. has been an extremely important one, has made a lot of progress, and has built a broad coalition that's much broader than African-American or civil rights organizations. And similarly, I think equal rights for gay and lesbian people is an important issue. Then it has also built a very broad coalition that expands far beyond the LGBT community. So I don't think it's about comparing one versus the other. I think they're all important. And I'm delighted to see that we're making progress in all the areas.
And my final question is, we have some significant issues in this country with the health and welfare of our Indigenous population, particularly children and maternal and child health. Can you respond to how those issues are covered in your country and what the differences are and what sort of things you may have had to do with that?
Yeah, I actually had quite a bit. Again, one of the program areas that I was responsible for within the Administration for Children and Families was Indigenous Affairs, what we would call Native American Affairs. And we had an entity called the Administration for Native Americans. And what we did, we really operated in several specific areas. We tried to encourage economic and social development in Native American communities. We tried to encourage the preservation of languages. There are many Native American languages, hundreds of them in the U.S. Sadly, many of them are dying out. There are very few native speakers of many of the languages. Many of them were not written languages in the first place. And so we had programs to try to encourage the preservation of native languages. And we tried as much as possible to be responsive to Native communities and the particular issues in Native communities in all of the work we did. So we did tremendous consultation with Native communities every time we were developing a policy to make sure that it was sensitive to and respectful of the particular impacts and the particular realities of Native communities. I have just begun to learn in my week here a little bit about the Aboriginal communities in Australia, but I certainly don't consider myself an authority. But it's interesting that the issues are being dealt with here, and that I know there's a long history in Australia of working with Aboriginal communities, as there is in the U.S., and I actually personally am interested in learning a good deal more about it and seeing where some of those parallels might exist.
Because you also were very heavily involved with the project in Harlem with the housing there as well, which was a 17-year project.
I'm not sure exactly which one you're familiar with, but...
With the... HIV housing project.
Yes,
that was
yes.
The project had actually been going for 17 years, and you were involved in the culmination of that project.
Yes, this was a project to develop a supportive housing program for people with HIV, and it had to go through a whole series of community approvals before construction began. And I was delighted that I sort of came in at the stage where that had basically all of the hurdles had been crossed, and I was able to participate in the ribbon cutting when that project actually became operational, which was a very exciting thing to be able to do.
Where do you see yourself in 5 years?
I am, well, you know, my lifelong commitment is to human services, and I'm delighted now to be able to do that work within KPMG. I'm delighted to be able to do that work across international boundaries in my current role heading the Center of Excellence, as you referred to, and I hope to be doing that for a long time to come.
Personally, for yourself, some travel or anything that's been something that you've really wanted to go and see, go and do?
Come to Australia. To me, one of the really exciting things about this role that I've taken on for KPMG is that it is giving me the opportunity to travel around the world and visit countries that I frankly never thought I would. So it's wonderful to be here in Australia. I've had the opportunity recently to be in India and Singapore and a few other places. And it's just great to have the opportunity, frankly, like this, to have dialogue with people around the world and exchange ideas and exchange issues and meet new people.
In terms of passing comments, I suppose the one question that we can't leave, even though I said my last question would be the last, is who's going to win the election? As someone who's inside or has been inside in the Obama administration, how do you think the election and the campaign's going there, and how do you think it'll turn out?
I have absolutely no idea how it will turn out. I think, honestly, I think it's impossible at this point to predict. I think
It's that close?
I think it's very close, and I think a great deal could happen between now and November. So time will tell.
This has been Sammy and Jeffrey on Gay Newsweek. We've been talking with David Hansel on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
Hey, what are we going to say in the promos for our show?
Well, what more do we need to say?
Isn't it obvious?
Well, we're gay.
And we're talking about news.
And we're doing it every week.
Gay. News. Week. Join Jeffrey, Sammy and Matt with Gay News Week every Wednesday at 7 here on Joy 94.9.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.